Today is Friday, May 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, tensions continue to rise between the U.S. Attorney General and Congress over the Russia report.
Nobody is above the law, not the President of the United States and not the Attorney General.
The unrest continues in Venezuela as Russia has a warning for the U.S. Also ahead, after 60 years of performing, an iconic American singer gets ready for her very last concert. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler said Thursday that Attorney General William Barr's moment of accountability will come soon enough after refusing to comply with demands related to the special counsel's report on a probe into Russia's interference into the 2016 presidential election.
If he does not provide this committee with the information it demands and the respect it deserves, Mr. Barr's moment of accountability will come soon enough.
Barr failed to show up to testify before the House committee Thursday, with the Justice Department objecting to a move to allow staff lawyers to take part in the questioning. The Justice Department also dismissed a committee deadline to provide the committee with a full, unredacted version of Mueller's report. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had harsh words about Barr's Wednesday testimony to the Senate.
He lied to Congress. He lied to Congress. If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime. Nobody is above the law, not the President of the United States and not the Attorney General. Being the Attorney General does not give you a bath to go say whatever you want, and it is the fact because you are the Attorney General.
But Trump ally Senator Lindsey Graham said Democrats are just going too far and need to stop.
I just think it's over the top. I think it says more about her than it does Bill Maher. I don't believe he lied.
Alan J. Lichtman is an American political historian who teaches at American University in Washington. He joins us now to discuss these unprecedented events. Thank you for being with us, sir. What do you make of all that has happened between the president, the attorney general, and Congress since special counsel Robert Mueller finished his report?
Clearly, there is always a tension between the Congress and the president. But we haven't seen anything like this since the days of Watergate, since the corrupt Nixon presidency. And Donald Trump clearly has taken a page out of the Nixon playbook and is continuing a pattern of obstructing justice. That Mueller didn't reach a final conclusion, he certainly could not have exonerated the president of, and laid out 10 pretty clear examples of attempts to obstruct justice. And that is continuing with William Barr as nothing more than an agent of the president, not someone who is representing the law or the interests of the American people. And Trump is daring the Congress. He is daring the Congress to give him any consequences for his action. And there's only one way that can happen, and that is for the Congress to open up an impeachment investigation. There are so many grounds to investigate, of course, obstruction of justice. Let's not forget President Trump was credibly accused of 2 felonies for violating campaign finance laws by the Southern District of New York. There's abuse of power. There is violations of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. There are possible financial crimes. But one of the articles of impeachment that the House Judiciary Committee voted against President Richard Nixon was his refusal to honor lawful congressional subpoenas. That's the only way to hold this president accountable.
So he's basically playing chicken with them to see what they'll do. And there are analysts that think he wants to get impeached. Politically, it would seem that they've really put Democrats in a bind. Americans are watching and thinking, where is the rule of law? Democrats, if they go through the impeachment process, it will not go anywhere because Republicans in the Senate won't impeach this president. But if they don't do it, then they look like they're not fulfilling their obligations under the Constitution. So where do they go from here? And where is the rule of law? And how do Americans feel confident that ultimately the truth and democracy will prevail?
I cast my first vote in 1968. Following politics for 50 years. I'm a professor of history. I've been studying our history from the founding to the present. This is the most serious threat posed by President Trump to our liberties and constitutional order since the Civil War. It cannot be met with timidity, and political calculation. U.S. Constitution gives the House of Representatives sole authority to impeach. And clearly, there are so many grounds now for opening up an impeachment investigation that was the House not to do it, they'd be derelict in their duty, and they would become a worse enabler of Donald Trump than the Republicans. It is not the constitutional duty of the U.S. House to look into a crystal ball and to figure out what the Senate may or may not do. That's a separate process. But never forget that if the House votes articles of impeachment, you are going to have a trial. Senate can't shirk that. And at the trial, the prosecutors from the House can make their case in great detail with the American people's attention riveted on it. And the president's attorney would be forced in this most public of venues to defend him. That in and of itself is of enormous value. And who knows after a trial what might happen in the Senate. One of the Lichtman rules of politics is that for incumbent office holders, their number one, maybe their only priority is survival. They're not going to go down the drain with Donald Trump.
It's also pretty stunning that Mr. Barr and now the White House attorney are looking to discredit Robert Mueller, who really seemed untouchable as far as his credibility.
It just shows how deceptive and treacherous William Barr, the president, and his allies really are. When they think that maybe Mueller is really supporting us and we can use Mueller's findings to exonerate ourselves, Mueller was this fine man, this impartial, respected investigator. Now they realize that's not the case, without a blush, they turn around and begin attacking Robert Mueller. It's just about as disreputable as we've seen. I do think Donald Trump is more of a threat to our liberties and Constitution than even Nixon was. And we still don't know whether he is compromised by the Russians. That is an issue that was not addressed in the Mueller report, and Congress certainly needs to look into. There are so many actions by this president, including his bowing and scraping to Vladimir Putin at Helsinki, that certainly at least raise a suspicion that needs to be investigated that in some other way he may be compromised by the Russians.
And we will be right back with the second half of our interview with political historian Alan Lichtman. You're listening to International Edition.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
And now back to the second half of our interview with Professor Alan Lichtman on the ongoing battle between President Trump, Attorney General Bill Barr, and Congress over details of the special counsel's Russia report. Mueller fielded out quite a few investigations to other entities like the Southern District of New York, but my understanding is that William Barr, the Attorney General William Barr, oversees those, you know, those courts or those jurisdictions as well. So who's to stop him from putting those to bed as well?
There's absolutely nothing to stop him from obstructing those dozen or so investigations that were farmed out to U.S. attorneys who are under William Barr's supervision. William Barr has shown that there is no end of treachery to the way he is operating as Trump's minion, not as the Attorney General of the United States. We can only hope, though, that if he tries to do that, we get some pushback in a very public way from those U.S. attorneys. And that certainly would be grounds for charging William Barr with obstruction of justice and impeaching him as well, and then perhaps even prosecuting him after he's impeached.
I think a lot of people were surprised. A lot of people thought, no, he wouldn't do anything to compromise his career at this point in his career. I think some people that really gave him the benefit of the doubt are sort of scratching their heads, wondering why he would go to this point.
Well, I think there are some good explanations. One, if you look at his history, he went pretty far the last time he was Attorney General to deceive the American people and to really push at least the edges of the law when it came to the rights of Americans to interfere in foreign lands. He also pushed for pardons for figures implicated in the Iran-Contra scandal. He wrote a 19-page single-space memo basically saying the executive can do whatever he wants with impunity. And the other thing, on a broader sense, Trump corrupts everything he touches. He's corrupted the Environmental Protection Agency. He's corrupted, as we know, the Interior Department, those two agencies that are so critical for protecting our environment and fighting climate change are now nothing more than puppets of the fossil fuel industry. He has corrupted the White House process, apparently for giving out security clearances. I can go on and on, but somehow either people have to resign or they're going to fall within this horrible orbit of Donald Trump corruption.
People are stunned that Republicans are basically complicit through all this. They don't want to hear it. They just are sort of going against all the things that they said they stood for. Why do you think that is?
The Republican Party is a moral catastrophe. They have simply become the enablers and agents of this president. The reason is simple, the Lichtman rule of politics. For incumbent office holders, their number one, maybe their only priority is survival. And they are cowards. One of the congressmen today brought in a chicken to describe William Barr. Well, you can bring in 1,000 chickens to describe the Republicans. They are afraid that if they challenge this president, that they are going to face primary contests and lose their precious seats. That's really what's going on. I assure you that if Barack Obama had done one-tenth of the things that Donald Trump has done, the Republicans would have him riding out of town on a rail.
Certainly the large field of Democratic candidates are concerned about the Russian issue, interference, and all indications are that Russia will interfere with the 2020 election, possibly with even more experience this time around. And it doesn't appear that this administration is doing anything to fight that Russian interference. Maybe they welcome it again. We don't know. But how concerned are you that it could dramatically impact the presidential race?
I am immensely concerned. When the founders framed the Constitution, their number one fear about what could destroy their republic was foreign intrigue and influence. As Alexander Hamilton said, foreign intrigue is the Grecian horse of a republic. And unless we take strong action, and the Trump administration has shown no inclination to do that, our democracy really is in peril from this foreign interference. As you say, they've faced no consequences from doing it. They're going to do it again. They're going to do it in and actually manipulate election results. And Donald Trump, and his Mueller document, didn't welcome Russian interference because he thought it would help him, and there's no doubt he'd welcome it again because he has no morality, no shame.
All right, that is American political historian and American University professor Alan Lichtman. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Catholic services in Sri Lanka capital again canceled due to terror threats. Russia and Iran maneuver for influence in Syria. When mass shootings drive survivors to suicide. And WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is refusing extradition to the U.S. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States is tightening its economic sanctions on Iran by ending a set of waivers that had allowed some of the country's largest oil buyers to continue their purchases. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara has that story.
A strike at Tehran's lifeline as the United States moves to end Iran's oil export. Earlier this week, the Trump administration announced it will stop giving waivers to China, India, Japan, South Korea, and Turkey, countries that continue to buy Iranian oil after Washington pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal with Tehran last May and reinstated sanctions. If they do not comply, they too may face U.S. sanctions. Mike Pompeo is the U.S. Secretary of State.
Any nation or entity interacting with Iran should do its diligence and err on the side of caution. The risks are simply not going to be worth the benefits.
In dealing with adversaries, the Trump administration often turns to unilateral sanctions rather than build coalitions to pressure a target country to change its behavior, say some analysts.
Well, the U.S. State Department calls the move a fulfillment of Trump administration's promise to get Iran's oil exports to zero and deny the regime the revenue it needs to fund terrorism and violent wars abroad. China, India, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Turkey, Italy, and Greece were the countries with waivers. And for more now on how these nations are reacting and if they'll comply, VOA Asia's Ira Melman talks to Samantha Gross with the Brookings Institution.
You know, the Asian nations were taken by surprise when Washington pulled back the sanctions, and they didn't give them very much notice that they were going to pull back the sanctions either. And so there was definitely some consternation among Iran's customers in Asia and some surprise that they couldn't buy Iranian crude.
So what happens now? Do you think that China is going to go ahead and continue consuming Iranian oil? The same with India? Already Taiwan has said it would not. I'm not sure about South Korea. What do you think is happening here?
Well, the China situation is the most interesting one to start out with. The Chinese are particularly frustrated at the U.S. imposing multilateral sanctions. And the Chinese already have one or more banks that are under sanctions. And so they're likely continue buying some Iranian crude through entities that are already sanctioned. Certainly the main Chinese banks don't want to deal with U.S. sanctions and they won't touch these deals, but there are some entities in China that may be willing to finance these deals and to facilitate them. The other countries are much more likely to comply. India is frustrated with us, but I think India is likely to comply. Taiwan and South Korea are likely to comply for the most part. I think the really interesting question is in China.
Well, China and India, according to some reports, are trying to set up a trading block as far as oil is concerned. What can you tell us about that?
You know, they're trying to set up entities where they can obtain Iranian oil without going through the U.S. banking sector, which is where the sanctions would come in. This is a tricky thing for us because it's an advantage for the United States that oil is priced in U.S. dollars. And so mechanisms that move away from pricing oil in U.S. dollars are probably not best for the United States in the long run. But they're also challenging for Iran. Rather than having hard currency for their oil, they might get paid in rupees or in renminbi, and that is not ideal for them. However, it's better than not selling that oil at all.
So do you think this is a done deal? Some Chinese officials were in India last week, apparently talking about it. And do you think that the U.S. or President Trump, as the case may be, made the wrong decision as far as deciding not to extend the exclusivity?
I'm not sure if it's a done deal. I know they're talking about it. Whether or not he made the right decision is a really tricky one. It's a geopolitical question. I know he feels strongly that he really wants to bring Iran's exports to zero to maximize pressure on Iran. But you have to think about how that affects our allies, particularly India, that has significant purchases from Iran and will have to do some reshuffling to replace those, and how this plays out in the Chinese trade negotiations that are going on right now. This is definitely an irritant for other foreign policy goals. And it looks like the administration has made a trade-off between wanting to put maximum pressure on Iran and perhaps putting that ahead of some of these other foreign policy goals that they have.
So where do you think what effect this might have on the U.S. trade negotiation, U.S.-China trade negotiations?
You know, there's definitely a lot of impetus for both sides to come to a deal on the trade negotiations. They'd both like to see the tariffs come to an end. President Trump, I believe, is really wanting to have a deal in hand.
All right, that is Samantha Gross with the Brookings Institution talking to VOA Asia's Ira Melman. The unrest in Venezuela continues. President Nicolas Maduro faces enormous pressure to step down, both from within the country and from the United States. But the former union leader has held on to power and weathered an uprising this week involving military officers. And there is a war of words ramping up between the United States and Russia. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Wednesday warned of the most drastic consequences if the U.S. continues what it calls aggressive steps. Pompeo also said Wednesday that the U.S. is prepared to use military action in Venezuela, but didn't say what would prompt that. Joining us to talk about the situation is Carlos Eduardo Moreo. He is Venezuelan and an associate with the Australian National Center for Latin American Studies School of Politics. Thank you for being with us. What can you say about Secretary of State Pompeo's warnings?
Military intervention is clearly a possibility from the U.S. side. And, of course, military intervention, the threat of military intervention is also something that keeps opposition actors within Venezuela safe. You know, it means that they haven't been imprisoned. It means that they haven't been arrested, etc. You know, that stronger moves against them haven't been put forward by the government. Nevertheless, a U.S. military intervention, I think, would be disastrous for the country. And partly because it would also lend itself to what Chavistas have been saying. Right? Chavistas have been saying for years that here is a socialist revolutionary government, a revolution is being effected in the country, and that it is largely the forces of imperialism that don't allow the country to mend itself, right, you know, to go forward. So an intervention would kind of play into that narrative, that, you know, that it's just it's imperialism that sabotages the country, and the government has support. It also has armed groups that support the government, and I do think that some kind of intervention would inevitably lead to civil strife, possibly, and kind of a low-level insurgency within the country.
Why do you think that Maduro has resisted resigning, given all the international pressure and, of course, all the protesters and of course, Guaido, the self-proclaimed leader now? What do you think is keeping him from just stepping down?
Well, Maduro claims, and so do his close supporters within the government, that they won elections in May 2018. So in May 2018, we had presidential elections, which have been questioned and seen as kind of fraudulent by many other countries and, you know, around the world, in particular by the countries that then didn't accept the result, which was Maduro winning. But what was fraudulent about those elections wasn't the actual tally. What was fraudulent about those elections were the fact that no real recognizable candidate of the established opposition was able to run. Nevertheless, a candidate for the opposition did stand and did compete with President Maduro, and though lost the election. The elections were also boycotted by the opposition. Nevertheless, in those elections, that's where I get that figure of about 6 million people or so. 6 million Venezuelans voted in favor of Maduro. They would have voted in favor of Maduro most likely had any other candidate of the opposition stood forward as well. And those 6 million represent about 25% or so of the Venezuelan electoral roll, which is to say that the government has strong support. I think, you know, this is an important consideration. I think this means that any solution to the Venezuelan crisis needs to take into account, you know, the support that Maduro does have. But I also think this is one of the reasons why Maduro hasn't stood down, because the government knows that they do have a core of strong supporters among the Chavista populace. So that's one point. There's another point which also has to do, you know, with the more sordid side of Chavismo, right? So there are numerous figures within the government that, you know, have made a lot of money via corrupt acts relating to oil, relating to loans, relating to mining in the southern part of the country, drug trafficking, and a lot of these people would stand to lose plenty if there were a change of government.
How long can this go on, given the dire humanitarian situation on the ground there?
I mean, that's a great question. As a Venezuelan, I guess I would like to think that it can't go for much longer, because the longer it goes, the more ordinary Venezuelans suffer, right? The only people who aren't suffering are either the very, very wealthy or people in government. But ordinary Venezuelans are doing it very, very tough in the country. But then I also have to recognize that the situation has already been going for very, very long, right? So we've now had kind of 3 months since the 23rd of January. We've had over about 3 months of this kind of standoff, stalemate between opposition forces and government forces. And every now and then we see moves taken to up the ante to try and bring some sort of decisive blow against the opposition or against the government. But nothing has happened yet that is decisive. And I doubt that there will be anything that can be decisive. So I think this situation will continue until some kind of political negotiation between both sides takes place. But neither actor seems to be willing to go down that route yet.
All right, that's Carlos Eduardo Moreo. He is an associate with the Australian National Center for Latin American Studies School of Politics. And you are listening to International Edition on VOA. As VOA's International Edition continues, condolences are pouring in following the death Thursday of Tanzanian media magnate Reginald Mengi, ranked as one of the 50th wealthiest people in Africa and a pioneer in the area of privately owned media in the country. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
According to one of the radio stations he owned, Radio One, Reginald Mengi, the executive chairman for IPP Companies, who is ranked D as one of Tanzania's millionaires, died at dawn Thursday in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, where he had been receiving treatment for an undisclosed condition. The president of Tanzania, John Magufuli, sent a condolence message via his Twitter account, saying the death of Mengi was a shock and the two men were friends. The Tanzanian leader said he'll remember Mengi for what the leader described as Mengi's immense contribution to the development of Tanzania. A statement from the United States Embassy in Tanzania posted on Twitter says the embassy was deeply saddened by the passing of Mengi. The message said his impact on Tanzania's long-term growth and development has been beyond significant. Mengi narrated his business success story in his book I Can, I Must, I Will, in which he describes how he was born into a poor family but managed to beat circumstances and establish one of the largest businesses not only in Tanzania but also on the continent. Mengi started investing in businesses more than 30 years ago and was the first person to privately own media in Tanzania. Today, his company, IPP Limited, owns several TV and radio stations as well as newspaper in Tanzania, and it also holds interests in the beverage industry. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
American singer, songwriter, musician, and activist Joan Baez, whose contemporary folk music often includes songs of protest or social justice, is heading toward the final performance of her career in what has been a year-long farewell tour, which will culminate in July with a final performance in Madrid, Spain. The singer, whose songs are filled with themes about peace and social justice, says she's sorry to be ending her career at such a dark time in history in the U.S. Baez has performed publicly for over 60 years, releasing over 30 albums. She made her debut at the Newport Folk Festival in 1959. And on the telephone, hearing a voice I'd known a couple of light years ago, heading straight for a fall. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Calling from a booth in the Midwest. 10 years ago, I bought you some cufflinks. You brought me something. We both know what memories can bring. Bring diamonds and rust. Will you burst on the scene already? Yes, the girl on the half shell could keep you unharmed. Now I see you standing with brown leaves falling all around and snow in your hair. Now you're smiling out the window of that crummy hotel over Washington Square. Our breath comes out white clouds.
If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime. Nobody.